Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Wednesdays with Willa. I am your host, Willa White, and this is my weekly podcast show that airs on Wednesday mornings at 10 a.m. Eastern on my Facebook page, Willa White Medium. It's an opportunity for you to learn about spiritualism, mediumship, healing, faith, family, and more. And it's always such a pleasure to share time with my special guests that come on the show. We talk about various topics, and I encourage you to look back at the archive videos of the show so that you can fully enjoy 7 years. This is year 7 of Wednesdays with Willa. So you've got lots of great content that you can binge watch to your heart's content. And if you have some moments of just wanting to learn more about a certain facet of things, you can even type in the title. You can type in different guests' names, and it should pop up on my Facebook page, Willa White Medium, and also on my YouTube channel. So this goes out as well on the blogtechradio.com/LilyDaleRadio site. So I'm part of the Lily Dale Radio family, and you have the opportunity to check in on those shows throughout the week as well. So know that you have a wealth of opportunities here at Lily Dale Assembly, and I encourage you to look at the lilydaleassembly.org website if you'd like more information about our fantastic summer season program of events, as well as the Zoom classes that are offered during the off-season. And one of the things I want to make sure I mention is that with this holiday season upon us, people are in that giving, generous kind of mode and mindset. Feel free to give donation to Lily Dale Assembly. You can go to the website, as I said, lilydaleassembly.org. We are a nonprofit organization, and we definitely need donations to keep our programs and our community going. So without further ado, I'd like us to get into our topic for today, which is meditation through the ages. And we are blessed to have with us today Mark Thomas. Thanks for being here today, Mark.
Good morning, Willa. Nice to be back with you as well.
Absolutely. And those of you who don't know who Mark Thomas is, he is the co-founder and spiritual teacher at Fellowships of the Spirit. They focus on mediumship and intuitive development and healing. And Mark's been on the show before. We did a show called Improving Inner Silence. So for those of you who can't get, you're like, oh, I can't get quiet, I can't access that inner silence place, that would be a great show for you to go back and watch again with Mark Thomas when he was my guest in the past. And today, as I said, we're going to be talking about meditation through the ages. And so Mark's going to take us on a journey through various meditation modalities and also some tips. He'll share tips of how you can choose the meditation modality and practice that is best for you. So this is going to be a great show, Mark. I can't wait.
Thank you, Will.
Yes. Well, I'll let you get us started with this.
Well, meditation's been a practice, you know, spiritual practice for eons, probably as long as people have been around. And there's so many, as you just said, there's so many ways to do meditation. There's probably as many ways as there are people on the earth. So what's that, billions of ways to do it? So there's no, if you will, only way or one way to do meditating. It's a word that has many meanings to many peoples and cultures. So I'm going to start back, way back, and I'll frame that a little bit in terms of what I'm speaking of in terms of meditation, and then I will branch a little bit into some of the other forms that are present, have been present for a long time, and in the New Thought, New Age universe, there's nothing new under the sun. The things that are out there and being proposed, whether it's apps for your phone or your computer or other things to help guided meditation and so forth, all that, it's not new. It's been around for a long time. It's just resurfacing and being repackaged, if you will, to present to the public in different forms today. So I'll start way back. I'm going to go back 2,500 years to the time of Buddha, one of the greatest teachers in our recorded history, in India, in his work was, his teachings were very simple, Four Noble Truths. And first one is that there's no such thing as permanence. Everything that we experience in a human life is impermanent, including our own lives. And then the second one is that life has suffering. Deal with it. You know, nobody avoids that. Nobody can get out of that. It's just part of the human experience. We have to process that. And there, the third of the truths is the concept of cessation of that suffering, which the prescription for that in his teachings is meditation. And then the fourth is right living, and that leads to the Eightfold Path and so forth and so on. It goes beyond that. But the simplicity of his teachings is both profound and also long-lasting as a result.
Yeah.
The Buddhist teachings heavily influenced as well the teachings in India, which came about 2,000 years ago in the form of the work of what's called the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. And that work was an encapsulation of the various streams of yogic teachings, the streams of yogic thought, into one very short collection of close to 200 aphorisms, which basically are the foundation of yogic teachings ever since.
Mm-hmm.
They are the definitive source of those. And that work is still very much available and translated into English and interpreted beautifully from Sanskrit, its original recorded language. But the whole first, there's four chapters to that. The first four verses of the Yoga Sutras that potentially capture the essence of the entire volume. And most people will read right past those and miss the teaching. That's the most fundamental teaching. And I'll recite those for you just so you get an idea what those are. First one is this, and now at this auspicious or this blessed moment, the teachings on yoga begin.
Mm.
And that is a statement, when you look into the Sanskrit a little deeper, he's saying that he didn't create yoga, potentially. He's summation. He's bringing all this together in a very usable, malleable form that can be used by the everyday person on a daily basis versus something that he's created. He didn't create this, and he's stating that opening statement. In this teaching begins. The second of those is yoga is the settling of the mind into silence. And that is followed by the third one. Once settled, you are established in your essential nature, which is unbounded consciousness. And the fourth one, unbounded consciousness, usually overshadowed by activity of your mind. Okay?
Yeah.
Right there. That's the essence of the entire Yoga Sutras, potentially. Right there in front of your face, and most people read right by it and go, yeah, so what? And they're looking for detail. That's the world we live in today. Well, the world is detailed. Information, you know, what's the skinny on this? How do I get to the, what can I do with this, you know? And he gets there too, but in the Yoga Sutras. But the essence of it is getting to that unbounded silence. It's deep inside all of us. The Psalms, the Hebrew Psalms, 46 Psalms, verse 10, be still and know that I am. Be still and know that I am. Know the source. Meister Eckhart, 13th century mystic. I love this quote from him. I'll throw the glasses on to read this short. There is a silence inside each of us that beckons us into itself. And the recovery of our own silence can begin to teach us the language of heaven. For silence is a language that is infinitely deeper, more far-reaching, more understanding, more compassionate, and more eternal than any other language. There is nothing in creation that resembles God as much as silence. Meister Eckhart, 13th century mystic. And then you start moving into the more later phenomena of the age of, as they call the Enlightenment, where you know, effectively what that is the time where printing press was invented. And so information started to be become the means by which, you know, people got educated, societies developed, knowledge was spread throughout the world, and a lot of these teachings that were, the, if you will, the mystical teachings, the inner teachings about how to get to the source, that that silence, that unbounded consciousness that potentially speaks of, and it, the Buddha also teaches in the form of nirvana, was taken inside. It became more in a cloistered environment is where you could get access to that information, those teachings. So they were very heavily guarded and guided as well. It was very guided teachings. And so it became a trend away from where both the Buddha and Yoga Sutras have potentially, and Meister Eckhart as well, was this needs to be to the masses. And in that Enlightenment era, instead of it continuing and growing outwardly, it was all brought inside to cloistered environments, ashrams in India, Buddhist temples, and also in the Roman Catholic traditions, which kept it, you know, and the Kabbalah traditions of Judaism. It's all very guarded now. It's very guided and very guarded, and so it wasn't continuing to spread. It was actually brought inside, and in some ways, that helped keep the teachings alive during all the ages that we've gone through, the transitions and the amount of change. But at the same token, it suppressed the spread, and the outer life, the material life, became more prevalent. The importance of information nowadays in the world we live in today, the dominance of information over transformation, we're living in that. We're living with both the good and the bad of that, yeah, the plus and minus of that kind of living. And so in the 1960s, 70s, these teachings started coming out of India, out of the ashrams in India, and out to the public where people were starting coming in from the East and say, yeah, well, there's this whole other aspect of your spirituality that is out there, but you haven't been taught it. So you had the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. You had many other teachers like that coming out of India teaching Yogananda in the 40s and 50s. You had many others like that coming out and their followers saying, hey, you can learn this stuff. You can get the benefit of getting to this unbounded silence within, and it's very simple and easy to get there. And you don't have to work at it a lifetime or be worthy of getting to it. And that also then opened up a lot of the Roman Catholic teachings to come outside of their walls. And they decided, well, maybe we should start teaching this so that the Eastern folks don't take over our spiritual prominence in the West. And so there's been this, since the 1960s and 70s, there's been incredible movements towards meditation, contemplation, guided meditation. Spiritualists have embraced meditation again. In the earlier years of modern spiritualism means, in the 1800s, it was very prevalent because they really evolved out of the transcendentalist movement that Emerson and Thoreau were leading. And so their meditation was a big part of what they did back then. And then it got lost. It got caught in the phenomena of spirit communication, the phenomena of hands-on healing, and all the other phenomenal aspects of spiritualism. And a lot of the focus that came from that deep inner work that came out of the transcendentalist movement was kind of pushed to the side. But even now, that's re-emerging, too, in spiritualism. So if you look around the world through history, meditation has never left us. It's just transformed in terms of the means and methods, but people have always realized that you've got to go deeper. You've got to get to that unbounded silence. It's a gift that we all have. It's a grace, and it's inside all of us, and it's really nothing you have to get outside of yourself. It's a way. You just need the way in to it. And so, yeah, that's a quick summation, very quick, of a whole lot of evolution of thought and experience that's gone on, but I try to encapsulate as best I could how this has emerged and evolved, and it's taken various forms. So go ahead.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I'm so glad that you were able to highlight some of those most important elements of the history of meditation, shall we say. And I think the other part of that is there's a place in all of us that does know that we're connected to God, and that's the place that we're accessing during those times. And I know you're going to be covering some more of the different meditation modalities, but I think that's a good historical overview in terms of a little bit of the East meets the West in terms of that. Yeah. And also their native cultures and how they decided that they would commune with God and be in meditation and have those experiences for themselves too. So, yeah, beautiful.
Yeah, the shamanistic cultures, and I would include the indigenous, the North American in that, that ethos,
mm-hmm.
are all, the medicine people, the folks that were the men and women who were the folks who were the spiritual guides, all were working from that deep level of unbounded consciousness. They would get to that space. And they were brought along. They were taught that. They didn't just land on special people. Certain people were taken and cultured with that.
Mm-hmm.
They were taught the ways to get there. And then from that space, they would provide guidance to the. They were the prophets. They were the folks that were the guides. And not only when they said medicine, they meant on a much larger dynamic than what we call medicine today, which is what you get at a pharmacist. Medicine to them was the way in which we need to move forward. It was really the prop. They were the prophets and the healers.
Yeah.
And, so those traditions are rich with that, too. But their teachings, too, were basically very deeply focused around certain people in their society that held, if you will, the light for the others.
And do you feel that certain kinds of meditation are good, let's say, for the everyday person? And then there are other meditations that are better for those that have worked through some of those other things within themselves and that it's more accessible for them to reach higher or deeper, as the case may be, into themselves and into their soul because they're ready to do the work. And that's why some of those things have been so cherished, treasured, or are kept behind the gates of the castle.
Yeah, there's a lot of ways that you can approach adding meditation to your life. You know, one of the key things coming out of India is the understanding that there are folks who are what they call the ascetics, or the ones who are the folks that go off and live in the Himalayas in caves, and or they're beggars, or they live off the land, off of the people, and they don't own anything. They're not a householder. they're a totally different walk than what's called a householder.
Yeah.
The householder walk is what we do. That's what you and I do, Willa, and everybody else around us. You know, we're living the householder walk, and the householder walk is our spiritual walk is our everyday life.
Yeah.
People think, oh, my spiritual practices are my spirituality. No. The message coming out of yogic teachings, especially, out of the Buddhist teachings, is you're, as a householder, your everyday walk is your spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something you do because you go to Lilydale, you go to church on Sunday, or you meditate, every day, or whatever you do, all those practices that we can do. That's not that's a part of your spirituality. But your true place where you work out your existence here and why we're here is your everyday life as a householder. And so that's what we are. And so for us, the predominance of our activity in a day is not going into meditative states and hanging out there and avoiding life.
Right.
That's, if you want to do that, you need to go and live in an ashram or join a convent or a monastery or go off and be a hermit somewhere, whatever, and live the life you need to do. I mean, whatever you got to do.
I always joke.
If that's your walk. But that's not where we live. That's not where you and I hang.
I always
got
joke.
Kids raising, and I've got grandkids and work and,
That my definition of a saint is not someone who goes and lives in a cave going om all day. It's really easy if you're not interacting with people to be of that mindset. But if you are interacting with people, my definition is someone who in their everyday life is having to find grace and give grace. And there is a practice to that that's also centered around knowing how to find meditative moments in the mundane. And so that some people would translate that into mindfulness. I think of that as it's a combination of mindfulness, but it's also built on the intention to always go back to God so that you have the spiritual response. And it does take on the concept that we embody prayer in all that we do, even that which is considered mundane, and that in itself is a meditation.
Truly. It truly is. Mm-hmm. Your walk is a meditation.
Yes. Yes.
St. Teresa of Avila, pray without ceasing.
Yes.
You know, everything you do is a sacred act, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we live life as if it's not, quite often. And even the things we don't like are part of our walk, are part of our learning, are part of what we need to master here, why we're here in the first place.
Yes.
So, yeah, it's all part of that. So, yeah, the Buddhist teachings, and they've been very prominent of late. It's been focused around mindfulness,
mm-hmm.
you know, which is really addressing the second of the noble truths. And to some degree, the third, the meditation aspect. But the second is really about mindfulness is about, okay, I've got this stuff going on. I got places where I hang out. There's things that set me off. There's things that get me bogged down or what have you, or my attachments, they would say they're attachments to the results of things, the fruits of whatever life brings. And mindfulness is really a series of processes, internal ones, where you work through what those attachments are and what's holding you up, and you kind of chew on those and you work your way through those. That usually requires somebody to help you, guide you spiritually through that process. It's not something that most people can do honestly and thoroughly, let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Thich Nhat Hanh, one of the great Buddhist teachers of this last 100 years, came out of Vietnam, and he talks about the noble truths. He said, I reordered them. He says, I put meditation first, because if you do the meditation, it makes the mindfulness easier. It makes your coming to terms with the impermanence of life, of everything of life. It makes it easier to address that. And it helps your right living becomes easier as a result on all the various aspects of that, the Eightfold Path.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, meditation needs to really be the number one thing. And so, you know, my own experience, you can wrestle this stuff down. These are a lot of bears inside of us to wrestle, you know. There's a lot of things that we got going, and sometimes those are really okay. Sometimes, as the expression goes, some days the bear gets you, some days you get the bear, right?
Right, that's right.
It's like, yeah. So, and then the Christian movements and their monastic traditions have what they call Lectio Divina, and other contemplative methods, where they take a particular scripture that they're hanging up on, right? It's triggering their stuff.
Yeah.
And so they chew on that, they work that, and let the subtle meanings, that they would say, and let the Holy Spirit work with them and come through them and figure out a way to get through those things as a part of their spiritual life. So it's really not just about, it's not just going into the silence, but using going into the silence and bringing that silence up into, because yes. After you meditate and you get down into that deep depth of silence, it's not just an experience during meditation. It comes out with you, walk, and it kind of wears down as the day goes on, right?
Yes.
As you get more and more caught up in daily living as a householder as we are, and what ends up happening is you need to get back to that silence again and bring more of that up into our world of activity, and that aspect is something as householders that we desperately need, and that's where disciplined practice is crucial,
yes.
of bringing that silence up. But then there's all other ways that you can apply that, and that gets into the more phenomenal aspects of life and daily living, but it also gets into the more phenomenal aspects of things like spiritualism, i.e., your message work? How deep is the well you're going into when you're tuning in to spirit, whether it's spirit loved ones, whether it's guides and teachers, whether it's source? You've got to be able to get to that space.
Mm-hmm.
And the deeper you go, the deeper you can connect with the people that come to see you for guidance.
Yeah. This is very true. Because if you can only sink down to, let's say, a puddle, that's all you're going to be able to give people versus a lake or an ocean and the depths of that. I really appreciate what you just shared there, because it's absolutely true when it comes to doing the work and really sharing the gifts of the spirit that come along with that. And, you know, to speak to what you were just talking about, you know, reading some of those words, those scriptures, the devotionals, that's something that has always sustained me through things. Like, even in the busyness of life, just being able to pick up a book that has spiritual sentences in it, or a devotional, and reading that paragraph or a few sentences and feeling that infusion. It's like an infusion that I get to nibble on until I need another one. And so I consider it to be part of spiritual food, and that as mediums, as healers, even in other walks of life, we need to take in more spiritual food than we give out. And so by doing that, and some people, as you said, they were wrestling over the words. But for me, it's not a wrestling with the words. It's more of a, I get to eat all the goodness of that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's one good way to deal with it. And that's what you would hope to come to. It's also good to take on the stuff that triggers you. And that's where the Buddhists are really good at. You know, they'll say, so they'll get you in their mindfulness activities about the stuff that you ain't got worked out yet. It doesn't come so easily, but you need to get to, you know.
Yeah.
And their mindfulness approaches are both, they comfort you wherever you're afflicted, and they'll afflict you where you're comfortable.
Yes, especially if you're a person who is uncomfortable in your body, or if you have physical ills or situations of pain. The Buddhists are kind of brutal to some extent. They're like, sit there longer. Like, there's go deeper.
Go into the pain.
Into the
pain. Yeah.
And whereas all of us are squirming out of it going, this is not natural.
Yeah, and their point is what's not natural is how you got yourself there in the first place.
Yeah.
You know, they'll just roll it right back at you. Their walks are tough. I mean, people take Buddhism out and just all about, you know, Om Mani Padme Om, you know, and chants and all this stuff. It's like, oh, no.
They're brutal.
They work their stuff. And
And you will sit for hours in meditation. You will sit for hours and hours.
Yeah, you do like a Vipassana or some of the...
We're not trying to scare anyone, but it's the reality of it.
No, but that their methods are very, they can be severe, but they're very stringent and strident both. And they work if you work your way through that, and you can blast through things that you've been carrying around you don't even know you got. And so, yeah, it's not my favorite ways, but I was trained right out of college in meditation that really was transformational to me, was transcendental meditation through Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, which is really from the Shankara school of meditation from India, which there's a lot of schools of meditation from India. Shankara taught non-duality. He taught that basically all is one. And so in meditation through TM, it was always, you know, from the moment of the initiation, you drop into that profound silence. Like, holy cow. Now, you have other schools of thought, like Yogananda's teachings, that whole Kriya Yoga teachings, and those kind of come up through him and some of the others, is like, you've got to do all these breathing exercises for a while. Then you got to do these hatha yoga postures for a while. Then you got to do this. And it's like, oh, and then eventually we'll let you in on the how to get to the silence. But those will help you get there. Well, that's not untrue. It's just the long way around the barn.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh.
And with TM, it was just like, you know, we'll teach you how to get there. Bang, from the first meditation in. And for me, that was hugely transformational. That was a turning point in my life. That's something I've been looking for a very long time. I was raised Methodist and Protestant. And, you know, the thing about the Reformed churches and Christianity is they strip the mystery out. We Roman Catholics left the mystery as a part of the mystical as part of their teaching. They don't share much of it, but they do have it. The Reformation, Protestant Reformation direction stripped all of the mystical out and went for the words, in the printed words, the Bible, i.e. so-called Word of God. That's a reach. But anyway, if they study the history of the church and the languages and so forth, they'll find out that's a big, big reach. But anyway, that doesn't mean that the Holy Spirit can't speak through words, through whatever traditions, whatever. But, you know, the word itself, that becomes idolatry in the highest order, you know? But anyway, the idea that spirituality is an experience versus a set of beliefs is very Eastern.
Yes.
In the West, it has become, oh, the beliefs are what's important. What you believe about something is important. And in the East, it's all about experience and then figure out the beliefs. It's like a reverse.
Yes.
It's like a reverse.
So that's why I tell my students when it comes to meditation or mediumship that it's all about right practice and right intention. And when you're in those, when you have the merging of those two things, you've got it. So I come from both.
Yeah, it is the both end.
Yeah.
But the biggest thing I found is don't get the cart in front of the horse, because then all you're doing is caught up in materialism again, in consumerism, which is so much driving our entire culture right now.
Oh, yes.
Outer world. Our
tis the season.
To the nines, you know, and it's like, all you got to do is look at the marketing of spirituality as a thing to buy, a purchasable item, you know. It's like a commodity. Like, are you kidding me? It's right in here.
That's right.
It's right in here. And all you have to do is get people to have that experience of what's already their own versus to something they got to go out and get and bring to them.
Exactly.
That's materialism dressed up as spirituality.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and also,
like, okay,
part of the meditation practice and even the practice of spiritual development and unfoldment means that on a regular basis you're putting time and effort. You're putting time into your practice and intention into that practice. And that's where you get the most out of it. It's if you think that you can plant a field and never water it, you think, well, it's good. If you plant a veggie garden, you know there's tending that happens between the weeding of things, and there's the weeding of the mind that happens through meditation and through that deep practice as well.
And contemplative, yeah, and study. And
yes.
All the above. Yeah. So it's, yeah, when I work with children, it's so amazing because they are still so much closer to that silence than we do. We get too sophisticated for our own good as a self. And we're too well educated in the ways of the world, you know, and kids have this capacity to go in and out of that space so easily. And when I've worked with children teaching meditation, I take them down by a stream and sit them on the bank and say, okay, now, you ever been to a movie theater? Movie theater, yeah. Well, yeah, of course. And you know how, have you ever been there early before there's anything on the screen? It's just like that blank screen.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. And then they start putting stuff up. They start projecting images against that screen. So what you're seeing is the reflection coming back at you off of a screen. And that screen does not change. Yeah. Okay, so if that screen wasn't there, you wouldn't see anything, because what you're seeing is a reflection. What your senses and your hearing is all a reflection of something. It is not a, and that is, that count on the fact that that screen, that blank screen, never changed.
Mm.
They, I thought about that, and I said, okay, so now I want you to think for a minute that they're out here in the woods here, and you've got a screen going by you with sound, you've got birds, you've got trees rustling, you got all this going on. Now, you couldn't hear or see or feel any of that if there wasn't that blank screen behind that, just like in the movie theater. It doesn't change. It doesn't move. So I want you to close your eyes and just listen and kind of observe where you are, how you're sitting, how you feel, and just notice that behind all of that is a screen that never changes. And I've never seen adults drop like I've seen kids drop into that silence right then and there. Bang, they go right into it. And it's because they are so much closer to it than we are. And they go right in. You see it in their eyes and just like, wow, whoa. It just registers for them, you know. And they get it, that unboundedness is never changing. It's that absolute nature. It's that grace that is always there. And when you start living life from that perspective, it changes everything that you do. Not all at once, but a gradual progression. Because you know that that's never leaving you, and you can't add to it, and you can't take away from it, no matter what you do on an outer level. All you're doing is you're either getting caught in the force of the Yoga Sutras, usually overshadowed by activity of your mind. You know, we get busy in it, but it doesn't go anywhere. We go. We leave it. It doesn't leave us.
That's right.
That's a beautiful thought, you know. It's a beautiful experience.
We're never separated from the divine. We can have the illusion of separation, but we're never separated. That's what's so beautiful. So I know that you wanted to share some tips with people as far as how do they go about choosing the meditation modality that's right for them and the practice that's right for them. How do they, you know, through the ages there have been these different meditations, and of course there are meditation trends that are still going on today in modern times.
Yeah. I would separate them into a couple of forms.
Okay.
One is movement meditation. Let's start with that one.
Yes.
Qigong, yoga, depending on how they are taught, are all not about the postures and the body movements. They're about getting you to the silence. You learn those postures because they can help you get there. Find a yoga teacher, a Qigong teacher, a Sufi mystic, you know, whatever, that teaches universal peace, that can help you get to the fact that those are all designed to take you to that silence, in the interior silence. Those, the movements, the postures, all that stuff is a means, not an end.
And it's something to note that with the movement meditation that you're talking about, that the body is moving and it's also activating certain energetic channels in a person while they're doing those movements that make the meditation more powerful. Yeah.
Easier to do in the process. I have a dog behind me that is wanting attention. Sorry, Sophie. I'm busy, girl. She likes to meditate with me, so who knows what she's picking up on. All right, so then the next forms I would talk about are the contemplative forms, where you're taking things in, whether it's mindfulness or contemplative spiritual traditions, where you're taking spiritual or sacred passages and working them. Those can be a very powerful form of meditation too, as long as you realize that they too are a means, not an end. They are a means to help you work through things, to come to terms with things, to reach spiritual awareness and the joy that comes with that. There's so many ways in which those, I call them the mental forms, can be very productive and help you get things aligned in your life with your walk, whatever your walk is, whatever your vocation, your direction in life is, your calling.
Do you feel
and
that...
So go ahead.
And do you feel that that's a form of mind focus and concentration that people can then kind of hang their hat on those words, bring their attention to those words? It's a concentration of returning to the words and feeling the infusion of the words. Would you say that that sounds about right?
Yeah, that's that. And there she is.
Yeah.
She's showing up.
She looks like a spirit dog. It's hilarious. The whole time she's been doing that.
Sophie girl, yeah. That's my wisdom dog. Her name is Sophie.
She's gorgeous.
In Greek.
Yeah. Yeah,
she's just hanging out back here. So, back to your question. I feel that one of the ways you can approach that kind of contemplative, can you hold 1 second while
sure.
I try
yep.
to get her outside? I think she needs to go out, and I don't know.
She's distracting you. We can't hear her yeah. like you're thinking we can hear her, just so you know.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, she's not sound distracting.
No, I don't think she's distracting me.
Yeah.
I think she's distracting you more than anybody.
What do you mean? So,
it's like you're petting a spirit dog. Right now.
Yeah, well, she's right here. All right. The one of the ways in which I think there's great power in that form of meditation, and that is this, is it's like you've got the issue or the sacred text or a combination of those things, and you're working them mentally, but then you got to get to the point where you just be still with them. You just be with them mm-hmm. instead of trying to absorb, fix, adjust, incorporate whatever it is you think you need to do with it, right? And get to the point of being still and being at peace, or as I would say, be comfortable in your own skin with
mm-hmm.
them. And it's that moment where I would say that you are open in that moment of stillness where you just to come to terms with it as it is when you're open to the movement of the Holy Spirit, you're open to the movement of guides and teachers, if you will, you're open to assistance from other realms than this physical nature reality that we have. And that, it's not about you having to do the whole lift then. It's about you getting yourself to the place where you've attuned to what the issue is or what have you, and then you cut it loose. And when you, that moment where you cut it loose is where great awareness, great healing can take place. Great inspiration can come in. The next breath is a big breath, you know. So those ways are really, really profoundly powerful and effective. And the Buddhists wouldn't frame it quite that way, but yes, they do that. They get you to that place, that Zen moment. Boom, it's like when you finally let go of it all, and you get still, and then, boom, things are shifting. And there's a shift in consciousness that happens in your life, in your forms, personality, et cetera. So yeah, very profound and very effective. Oftentimes need guidance. You need somebody who can guide you with that because it's a challenging way to approach meditation.
Yeah.
It's a very fruitful way, but it also is challenging.
Yeah, I think it's about attunement. Those words can be used to attune and align a person.
Mm-hmm.
with the understanding of who they truly are and that who they will always will be as a soul. And I think it's going back to those foundations of knowing that so much of what happens is out of our control except for our reaction, and that it sets us back into that space of, oh, I need to be in that moment with the divine instead of having a knee-jerk reaction to this event. I will choose a spiritual response. And it's one of the benefits of meditation is that you can take yourself there and not just be about creating an aggressive emotional response that cements karmic entanglement further. So it's really to the benefit. Mm-hmm. So thank you.
Yeah. And another way is what I would call meditation, which is a quicker way just to get to the silence. And that's using focal points that are quick. First one is the Buddhists use extensively is paying attention to the in and the outflow of your breath.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, one thing that we all have in common is that while we're here, if we're not breathing, we're gone from here. Okay, breath is our way in, breath is our way out.
Yeah.
It's the doorway in, the life, as we call it here, and the way out. And it's the way in which we sustain life while we're here. And the Buddhists use that extensively as a means of going between the busyness of the mind, which is mm-hmm. there, and getting to that unboundedness that's underneath all of that. And the second way is very Vedantic, from India, the Vedic traditions, and that is to use mantras, very simple seed mantras, sounds that don't have any meaning to you in English or your language that you speak on a daily basis, but have a sound vibration that allows your mind to counteract the busyness of thought,
mm-hmm.
the internal chatter. So it's on the same wavelength, if you will, in terms of how it's initially uttered, but it has a deeper vibration that takes you deeper into that, past all of that and down into the silence.
Mm-hmm.
And the third is people that use visuals. And the visual can be a point of light on horizon that you bring in towards you and either inside the what they call the third eye here or the point on the forehead or just in front of you. And you bring that light in and you just concentrate. And it's really a form of concentration. And that form gives you, if you need a focal point like that, then it helps you with the concentration of light. Now, what I would say to you, though, to anybody, is pick one of those three. Do not hopscotch around. Or what you'll do is just be chasing your tail. And the reality is we need a methodology that feels like it works best for us.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got a lot of internal mental chatter when you're meditating, a sound or a mantra might be your best bet, or the breath. The visual one would be one of the hardest for you. If you're a person that doesn't have a lot of mental chatter but has a stream of imagery, then the visual might be your best bet.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a person that feels like you got a lot of body things going on that interrupt your meditation, use breath to get through those. And I tell people when I teach, it's like pick the one that feels best to you, like it's going to help you the most. Work with it for a period of time, a week, a month, and if it doesn't work, then shift. You'll know pretty quickly, but don't hop around inside the same meditation to the different focal points, because all it does is distract. Get your body and your nervous system conditioned to a way that actually does work for you.
Mm-hmm.
And some people can't sit still to meditate. So the movement ways are best for them, or the breath ways are best for them. Mantra meditations and visualizations, there's a dime a dozen of folks like that. You know, it's like, I can't do that. I don't want to do that. You know, I get too many pictures. You know. The other thing I want to say in terms of practical things, because you asked about that, was that people think that during meditation, your thoughts are keeping you from meditation. Wrong, wrong, wrong. Your thoughts are not a foe during meditation. They're your friend. So you just need to alternate a focal point or a body movement or awareness of some kind that you want to bring you to that stillness and the mental activity, the thoughts, the body sensations, awarenesses, the whatever's chatter, whatever's going on. So let that be a part of the process versus something you have to fight down or push down or push away, because it's like a jack-in-the-box. You just crunch back down in the, you know, and then boom, pops back up again. And that's exactly the way that plays out in reality. And it's too much work, and it's miserable. And that's one of the biggest things, Willa, that I get from people is, oh, I got too much thought during meditation. I go, oh, that's good. And then look at me like, good? How can you tell me that that's good? Well, let's look at some ways you can adjust this that'll work for you. But don't think that your thoughts and body sensations and things during meditation are your foe. They are not your foe. They're your friend.
And they're just part of life as well. I think people think that meditation is about interrupting their regular life. And it can be, but there's also that other side to it where you recognize that all of these things that are going on in and around you are always going to be part of the experience. And how you weave your awareness of consciousness through those moments is where the mastery comes from. And that's the way I would look
right.
at that.
Yeah. That's right. And but a lot of folks will get really bogged down. They're not meditating. I tell people, always do an internal check before you start a meditation. Where am I right now?
Mm-hmm.
And then stop evaluating, do the process, come out the other side and say, where am I now compared to when I started, before I started a meditation?
Mm-hmm.
If you feel there's been a shift, there's some change, that was exactly what you were looking for. I tell people, turn off evaluation when you're in meditation. You're a very poor judge of the experience when you're in it.
Mm-hmm.
You're a very poor judge. Sometimes in meditations, I had the busiest mind chatter or body issues and sensations, aches and pains and stuff going on are some of the ones when they came out were some of the most profound spaces I've ever come out into. Right?
Yeah.
Because it was like, oh, yeah. So, you know, all of that is so subjective, but the key is do an internal check before you start and after and go, okay, yeah, I am doing better than when I started. All right. Mm-hmm. Getting on with life. Get moving.
And
get on with your day.
I think that's a really important point you just made, Mark, because people think that with the meditation they're going to immediately feel peace at the end of it, and that can be a wonderful thing that is a byproduct of meditation, but sometimes there is some mud that gets stirred up. There's sometimes you end up having more questions than you had answers during that time. This is normal. That is spiritual unfoldment, and I guess making your own peace about having those experiences is what's important. That as you're working through your pain body or your monkey mind or the issues of the day, the laundry list of things that are about, sometimes people have to kind of have more of more time figuring that all out, and then they let it go, they let it go, they let it go, and then other things can be filtered in. And so there's a processing that occurs, and each meditation, even if you said, I'm going to do the same meditation every day for a week, it could be very different over the course of the week. It could be up, down, and all around.
I've never had two meditations to like in my entire life. I've been doing this for 40 some years. So, you know, it's like, don't ever expect you had last time to be like you're going to have this time.
Oh, and what about the people who fall asleep?
Because you're different.
Talk about the fall asleep people.
Yeah, that's an important one because I tell people, they go, I was asleep, and no, they probably were out in the unbound day, but I tell them, that's another one, don't judge during the meditation. When you come out, that's why I say you do the pre-check and the post-check, right? Checking with yourself. You do the post-check, and you come out, and you're restfully alert. I mean, you're, like, really kind of in your game. You know, it's like you're ready and embracing life, and you're really there. You were in that unbounded. You're bringing that unbounded up into this world of forms that we hang out in.
Mm-hmm.
If you come out of the meditation time, and you are groggy and foggy like you are coming out of a nap, you needed a nap, and you got a nap. But you might also meditated while you were there. But you also, more importantly, got some sleep you desperately needed. And when you sit down to meditate, and that's what ends up happening. And if that happens repeatedly, when you're coming out of the meditations in that groggy and foggy kind of space, where you've been like a nap, then you're not getting enough sleep in your life, or you've got too many things tugging and pulling on you, and you need to make some adjustments in your outer lives that are going to, so that when you sit down to meditate, that what you're going to be doing is releasing a lot of accumulated stresses and strains and fatigues that are stored in that body, but not having to go into deep sleep to get that done.
Mm-hmm.
And there are people in today's world, Willa, that are way over-programmed. They don't ever stop. They work 7 days a week. They, you know, push, push, push. They get fatigued, and they just push through it, and they don't rest. And I was guilty of that in a much younger life. Now that I'm retired from administrative work and all the things that I did for my profession, you know, it's much easier for me to, when I get really weary, is to just stop, you know, and sit down for a few minutes. do some deep breathing, kind of just go into a mantra meditation, which is what I use, and maybe 15 minutes, and boom, I'm back with the fatigue gone. I'm good for another 6-7 hours. But if I don't do that, then I'm pushing through. By the time I get to the evening, I am just shot.
Yeah.
Because it does catch up to you.
Absolutely. Any other tips you have for folks today about choosing the meditation modality that's best for them or just meditation in general?
I would say if you have somebody to guide you, it's really good. Somebody who has experience with it. It's not essential, but it's helpful because meditation does adjust our lives, our outer lives and our inner lives. So it's not an innocuous activity. It does have effects on all levels. So sometimes it's real. I would say be with somebody who can help coach you with those things. And if you don't find that right away, keep searching for somebody that can help you with that.
Yeah.
And there's people out there that can.
Absolutely.
Second of all, I would say is discipline practice is crucial. People think of disciplined practice as kind of a dirty words, you know, discipline. Stay focused. Do it repeatedly because, well, in this world, it's like instant gratification, right? And it's like this is anything but instant gratification. This is holistic transformation of your consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
That's what meditation is going to bring you. If you want to go for the long haul, then you got to get disciplined in your practice. You got to do it on a daily basis, and you need to be focused with it. And settle into whatever routine seems to work for you. If you want to make adjustments through time, you make them. But you've got to get disciplined with the practice, or the results are spotty. And the outer results is what you're after, not so much about the experience and what happens in meditation. For me, anyway, it's like, yeah, I know that's going to change. So
mm-hmm.
what I'm after is how is it going to enliven my outer life? And, boy, if I hadn't started meditating when I did when I was a lot younger, I would not be, you know, would not have accomplished anything close to what I did in my lifetime. So
yeah.
It's 70 years old, but now I'm like, yeah, it is the thing that's made the biggest difference in my life, you know, in terms of direction. Not only where I went, but how I did what I did and continue to do.
Mm-hmm. Those are really important points that you made with all of this. And I think other people need to also keep in mind that some meditations, you're doing them for a particular outcome, and some meditations, you're just there to see what comes. And I will just give an example of what I mean by that. Some people will sit in meditation for healing and for a greater understanding of their intuition in those moments, to receive, to open up a way in them to feel and understand and sense and know what the divine, what the God source is giving them in a particular moment in their lives so that they can move more into prayer and contemplation. And for some, it's so that they can enter into that mindful awareness of spirit in their lives and spirit loved ones around them. So there are meditations that have those kinds of focus. And then there are the meditations that are there to just help you learn how to be. You're in a state of being in that awareness of the divine. That it's not going to be necessarily about the outcome. It's going to be about the process.
Yeah, and it's that in and of itself is navel gazing, but it's really about how it affects your outer life.
Yes.
That third one.
Yeah.
It's how it will enrich your life holistically,
mm-hmm.
on all levels it will enrich your life. And it will make the other ones you just walked through
yes.
deeper and richer. Whatever you're doing with those, also carve out the space to get to the silence, get to that unboundedness,
mm-hmm.
because that will enrich every one of the other practices you engage upon.
Beautifully stated. Oh, this has just been so great. Thank you so much, Mark, for being on the show today and sharing this with people. I think it's been really important for